Happy Christmas from Radio Arian. Have a pro-white Christmas and a diversity-free new year. And remember, a kebab is not just for Christmas. You're listening to The Daily Traditionalist with Matthew Highmark at RadioArian.com.
Hello, comrades. This is your host of The Daily Traditionalist, Matthew Heimbach. And woo, what a day it is. Based off the conversation we had yesterday about Roy Moore in Alabama, we have got an interesting show today. And joining me to be able to kind of dig through everything that happened and what this means is the one, the only, Mr. Billy Roper. So, Billy, how are you doing today?
Good morning, Mr. Heimbach. I'm doing fine. How are you?
Oh, you know, very, very interested to see exactly what the fallout's going to be from this Alabama race, because on one hand, it seems to me this is, this just goes to show that the Republican Party will betray its own candidates. They did everything they possibly could to help Doug Jones win. They hate their own voting base. They hate the values they supposedly stand for. And still, Roy Moore almost won, which I think is pretty interesting. But the Republicans are diametrically opposed to their own base. And on top of that, now we've got essentially the Trump administration. It's going to be impossible for them to pass any legislation due to now the Senate only being in favor of the Republicans by one. And of course, the Republicans have so many essentially Democrats with an R next to their name. That's not actually a Republican majority. So there's a lot out there. I want to know your initial thoughts about what happened in Alabama and kind of what this means for all of us.
Absolutely. Well, you know, now it is, as you say, 51-49 with Republicans having that one vote majority. And they've already had to call in Vice President Pence to do a tie breaking vote last week. And obviously, they're going to have to do more and more deals when you have so many rhino establishment Republicans like McCain and Flake that are going to vote with Democrats anyway and are really Republicans in name only. We know that Trump and the GOP establishment supported Strange in the primary, supported the establishment more moderate candidate. And this is kind of a result in the Deep South of the end of segregation going back to the 1950s and 60s when the parties kind of flip-flopped and when the Democratic Party, which had represented white interest, began to represent non-white interest. And so whites began to slowly become Republicans, even though if you go back to the end of the Civil War and Radical Reconstruction, which was run by Republicans, many white Southerners were what we call yellow dog Democrats, which meant in the South, we would really vote for a yellow dog if you ran on a Democratic ticket. But now that's changed, of course, because we've finally recognized that the Democratic Party is now the party of non-whites. And so as moderate Democrats who were opposed to segregation, who were not racial, but were, I guess, a little bit right of center on other social issues, became Republicans, especially in places like the suburbs of Birmingham, they actually poisoned the white Republican base in the South and in Alabama by making it more moderate. And they established really the elite Republicans, the Rockefeller Republicans that now control state politics and much of the South. And so what led to the problem last night, you know, in Alabama was the national establishment, but also the state establishment, GOP supporting the moderate Republican in the primary, doing a lot of damage against Moore. And then you have the coastal liberals piling on with the Washington Post and the New York Times and the Jewish-controlled media attacking Moore with all these spurious allegations of sexual misconduct going back to really traditional values when he was a young man about 30 years old, maybe 32, coming out of the military, going back to Alabama, and he literally just wanted to find a decent girl who was still a virgin to marry. And so with their mom's permission, he dated these teenage girls, nothing, you know, at all perverted going on. He was trying to find a virgin bride.
I mean, it's important to add in here that He's not accused of rape. He's not accused of anything like that. As you said, and this is something that in terms of how the left perverts things, that traditionally the idea of a man being older than the woman, usually not as old in this case, but he was, you know, as you said, he had his own unique experiences to be able to provide for a wife and then provide for children, right? So a man generally is older than his wife. So he has more time to be able to establish himself as a protector and provider for his family. I mean, that's the natural way of how humanity has been for, I mean, really since the beginning, right? I mean, that absolutely makes sense. It only makes sense to have a wife that is the same age as you, or even older, if she's working, or if you've got this sort of feminist sort of worldview where you're not trying to create a family. But if you're going to create a family, it makes sense for the man to be older, to be more experienced, and to be able to have that ability to provide. I mean, so what do you think on that about just like these changing values? So many of the people that are like that voted in Alabama remember a time when that was still normal, but now they're all acting offended. I mean, it seems to me the Republican establishment is the most cowardly group of people you could possibly imagine, because they know it isn't what is being presented by, as you said, you know, the lying media. But they're going along with it just because they think Roy Moore is too extreme. It's incredibly, incredibly cowardly.
And dishonest, because actually they do, as you know, and as you say, remember a time when this was traditional values, when a gentleman who was about 30 years old would, with the parents' permission, seek their permission to, as a Southern gentleman, to date, to woo, to court their daughter under their supervision, under their chaperonage. And of course, there was nothing sexual that happened between them until after marriage. And he actually found his wife that way, and they are still married today. It was very wholesome, very traditional, nothing at all wrong that he did by anyone's standards, except for those who wanted to do the slanderous hit piece against him, the coastal liberals and the Jewish-controlled media. They were thinking that they could destroy his support among the white female base in Alabama by attacking him this way. But I think that here's, you know, a lot of people are black-pilled this morning about the Alabama election, but here are some white pills. One white pill is that they failed in turning white women in Alabama against Roy Moore. About 65% of white women, a big majority, a bigger majority than those in the state who voted for Trump last year, actually voted for Roy Moore. So white women, bucking the feminist message, supported Roy Moore yesterday. But even more than a gender issue, the election last night was a racial issue. If you look at the demographics, you know, there's a black belt in Alabama, which is basically parallel with Montgomery, that bisects the state horizontally. And then there's, of course, a black belt around Birmingham. Those are the two larger areas of African-American population. Now, black females voted for Jones by 97%. And blacks overall voted for Jones by 95%. Whites, on the other hand, once again showing it's strictly a racial vote, 70% for Moore. And for white males, almost 75%. So that means that this was a racial election, not even a gender election, even though the left and feminists tried to make it into a gender divide by attacking Moore based on his, you know, alleged sexual imperfections in the past. The reality was, this is a racial election, and like you and I have talked about, like we talked about last week, when we look at the Balkanization of America, when we look at African Americans moving back to the Deep South, to the former five Confederate states, especially in the core, and their actually birth rate exponentially higher than whites, and then whites responding by voting with their feet and moving out of the Deep South to the Upper South, we really could have expected this. And I think that it shows, you know, there are a lot of people who are black-pilled, and a lot of people who are trying to say, well, of course, there's a lot of voter corruption. Of course, there's a lot of voter fraud. Yeah, absolutely. That's what happens when non-whites vote. It's just like in South Africa and the former Rhodesia. There's a lot of corruption. But in reality, this shouldn't be a black pill for us. This should be a white pill, that more and more people on both sides are polarized and are voting racially, because that's what happens in a multiracial democracy. People don't vote for their economic interest or for their social or cultural issues, they vote for their race and for their religion, the two most important things intrinsically to all people. And so this was a racial election, which shows that Alabama, along with many other states in the South and across the country, is going to be divided racially, and people need to just be awakened to that and recognize it and not try to be civic nationalists and think that we can overcome our differences with some kind of false mythical commonality.
No, I mean, you're entirely right on this. I mean, one of the most important things for us to understand is this polarization, right? I mean, the idea, people ask you, how could you create an ethno-state? Well, it's very simple. It happens organically. People choose to live around people like themselves. They share generally the same worldview, the same desire for their children and the future, exactly how that's going to be accomplished with their own folk. So you see really the breakdown in America. It's not about these sort of egalitarian ideas. I mean, you know, I know for a fact that I would vote for a white guy, who was probably more of a centrist than I would a black guy that was more right wing, right? Because I just feel an intrinsic kinship with a white guy if I feel like he's being sincere and he's, you know, somewhat on our team. And the blacks do that. I mean, Marion Barry, let's not forget the perpetual mayor of Washington, D.C., you know, who was caught smoking crack with prostitutes, and he had that, you know, famous, blank, she set me up moment. That guy was basically in city government, like, till the day he died. It didn't matter that he was a crack-smoking, corrupt, absolutely, the epitome of this, like, petty third world style, backroom deals and whatnot. It didn't matter because, like, he was the black mayor. He was like the embodiment for the black people. And you're like, I'm not even mad about that. Like, good. Like, all right. If your politicians want to be corrupt, you know, which some of them will be great, some will be corrupt, whatever. But if those are yours, that's good. We just need that for our communities. But the center really has broken down. I mean, the Trump election was a big demonstration of this. But I think you're right. The Roy Moore case, that this Senate election in Alabama just goes to show that people are picking sides. This isn't so much about party, although, you know, party is basically a synonym now for race because the Republican Party is over 90% white and the Democrats are increasingly multicultural. And you've got a lot of the white liberals, like the real leftists, joining the Democratic Socialists or, joining the Green Party, stuff like that. So the Democrats really are becoming like the party of the non-whites. And we're going to see this more and more and more, no pun intended. You know, what happens is this comes down to a racial headcount. It is always going to be a racial headcount. That's how people work. That's how people vote. That's how people segregate themselves whenever they get the chance. And we're going to end up having to battle it out. And where balkanization comes in is the fact it's better for all of us. It's better for all of us. It's better for the blacks. It's better for the Hispanics. Better for the Asians. Better for whites. To, you know, instead of fighting each other, for control and hating each other, it's easier for us to just say we're going to go our separate ways. That's why balkanization is actually not just good for us. It's good for everybody. Because in a multiracial democracy, as you pointed out, we're going to be fighting each other like cats and dogs over a limited and ever-shrinking pie as the Jews and the capitalists take more and more and more. Instead, we need to be able to have our own nations, our own spaces. But the polarization of American politics, I think, isn't complete, obviously. But we're headed there where people aren't going to feel any connection to an American identity or American politics. Everything becomes racial. And white people probably aren't going to jump into it. They're going to be forced into it by other groups that already act this way, already think this way. You know, really, are people going to have to get off the sidelines?
Exactly. And, you know, one of the analogies I like to try to draw when I speak to people on the left is obviously they feel that colonialism in sub-Saharan Africa, for example, was wrong. Well, there's really no difference between the way that the Western European powers artificially constructed political boundaries in Southern Africa, which really overlapped tribes and ethnicities which would not have chosen to have been in the same nation state together, and forcing them together, and now they're continually at war and breaking up and forming new nations as we speak, balkanizing there in Africa, than there is with what's going on in the South and other parts of the country where you have regions within a state which are majority black or majority Hispanic or majority white that are actually creating solid blocks of regions within the state. In Arkansas, for example, in my state, the southern half of the state is majority black. The northern half is majority white. And that's becoming more and more stark in terms of difference every day. Dividing the South along the Mississippi River Valley, you have a large black belt. And then horizontally across the deep South, you have a large black belt. And that black belt runs through Alabama. We saw the effect of that. last night, but forcing people, whether they're black or white or Hispanic, to live together in the same artificial political construct where they don't have shared commonality of interest or destinies or cultures or common heritage that they like to share is just a recipe for disaster. And they're going to force something very bloody and very unfortunate and tragic on our nation by trying to, as imperial overlords and as colonial dictators, force our people to live together. It's going to be harmful for everyone. But I think that last night is another one of those signposts that people are voting racially, they're thinking racially. And ultimately, as you say, that's only going to be exacerbated in the near future.
Well, yeah, I mean, and, you know, one just has to look at the recent mayoral elections in Atlanta. And, you know, it really came down to race. It was a white independent versus a black female Democrat, of course, who was supported by, you know, the current administration in Atlanta is under a serious number of investigations on corruption. Tremendous amount of corruption investigations. You know, this is kind of, you know, the woman that's being brought in seems to be kind of a continuation of the previous administration, which, of course, we know Atlanta has had a black mayor for decades now. And it was just interesting to me. I mean, it was a very close race. But again, it just came down to a racial headcount. I mean, like, the black people would rather vote for, you know, someone who's tied up probably with the corrupt current administration instead of a white person who has none of that and actually has a very strong record of job creation, good policies that would actually help the city. Doesn't matter. It comes down to race. Everything comes down to race. Like, we've got to understand this. And that's why we have to have a team white. And it is too often, I think, optics cucking and stuff like that, you know, trying to get the approval of the media, of the system. We throw white folks under the bus that maybe they did something you don't agree with. Maybe you don't see eye to eye with them entirely. Doesn't matter. They're on team white if they're just, you know, relatively fighting for the 14 words. Because look at the black community. Like, they never break ranks when it comes to Trayvon Martin or Mr. Brown or, I mean, really any of them, right? You know, the Chicanos never break ranks on their own people. The indigenous, you know, folks on reservations never break ranks. They're always on their racist side, regardless of context in most cases, because that's a member of their family, right? We need to do that for our people and understand everyone else views this as a purely racial issue, whether it's politics, whether it's the economy, whether it's social institutions. They get that. We need to be on team white all the time because this is our people. This is our family. And we need to understand everyone else works collectively. If we try to work as individuals, we're going to get broken apart. We need to be one strong family when it comes to everything we do. You've got to think white. You've got to act white. You've got to vote white. You've got to, you know, and when it comes to money, you've got to be able to do that with a pro-white mindset. We've got to secede from the empire in everything that we do in order to empower our community to control our own destiny. And before I get, you know, too far off in the weeds, you know, Billy, one of the things we want to talk about is the upcoming court dates tomorrow for our POWs. And speaking of being on team white, this is such an important issue. Do you want to go into what is going on tomorrow?
Certainly, Matt. Tomorrow, of course, will be the hearing of four of the co-defendants in Charlottesville, Virginia. I had an opportunity yesterday to talk to the Goodwins, to Jacob Goodwin's parents, as they made the trip over. They actually got caught in a snowstorm in Kentucky, but they did make it through safely last night into Charlottesville, and they're staying with some supporters who are on Team White there in Charlottesville. And then this morning, they had an opportunity to visit with Jacob for an hour and a half there in the Charlottesville jail. So they had almost a two-hour visit with him, which was great. It was the first time that the Goodwins had a chance to meet face-to-face with their son, with Jacob Goodwin, since he had been extradited from the Lonoke County, Arkansas jail. So they were very pleased, and they were also telling me today how upbeat Jacob is, how optimistic he is and how courageous he is. Of course, he's very happy to be able to see his parents again, but he really feels good about tomorrow. Now, one of the things that we need to update people on is that DeAndre Harris, who was one of the African-American thugs who actually attacked Harold Cruz and led to the melee in the parking garage, which is going to be largely the focus of the hearing tomorrow, was released already. His felony count was reduced to a misdemeanor assault charge, and he was released with a suspended sentence and probation. Now, that might be upsetting and frustrating to people. I guess that's expected, but the reality is that it now sets the precedent for the same treatment, if there was any kind of fairness at all, to be given to the white co-defendants as well. So tomorrow at the initial hearing, then Jacob and his lawyer, Elmer Woodard, and the other co-defendants will have an opportunity to make another appeal for bail to be granted. We do know, of course, that bail has been granted to Christopher Cantwell after two of his charges were dropped, and he's now with an ankle bracelet and with a $25,000 rather secured bond in Virginia. He cannot leave the state, but he is currently free, at least out of jail. And so there is a possibility that tomorrow bail may be granted under similar circumstances to some of the co-defendants. It certainly is going to be applied for, and they're going to then try to hold all four of the preliminary hearings tomorrow, which that's going to be a stretch. They may be held over until Friday or even later. But his parents are there with Jacob in Charlottesville now and hopefully going to have a positive outcome for the entire defendants tomorrow.
Well, and we've got to keep everyone in our prayers. I mean, that's really what it comes down to. I mean, Christmas is coming up, and how amazing of a gift would it be to have our boys home? You know, another thing is, you know, we know Mr. Fields has a court date tomorrow, and we know he's not getting bail, right? I mean, that's one of those things. And you'd think, you know, in the American justice system, where it's innocence, you know, and innocent until proven guilty, right? That's the way our system is supposed to work. But Mr. Fields was tried, as the other defendants were, for various things, by the media before an investigation had even been done, before, you know, sober minds and clear heads could actually sit down and determine what happened, right? In the age of, you know, clickbait media, that it was already decided before, really before the incident was even over, what the narrative was going to be. And, I mean, we just see all the time with the left where they like to memory hole stories, you know, the bomb that was set, you know, that was prevented by a Texas Ranger at the Confederate Memorial, the attacks that radical leftists have done, you know, against nationalists, Trump supporters, that's all forgotten. But anything they can run with to try and demonize white folks, to try and demonize, you know, their political opponents, they'll run with. And, you know, it might be a controversial statement, but, you know, being on Team White, you know, we've got to understand what situation, because everything's been put forward about the Fields case as well, comes down to a young man by himself who was being attacked and feared for his life. And, you know, stuff happens when you fear for your life. And the law makes allocations for that. And I feel like in the nationalist movement, for fear of, you know, the SPLC headline, you know, so-and-so, insert name here, you know, endorses Fields. It's not about endorsing things that happen, but he's a young man who is in jail, feared for his life. We know, everyone knows, the media knows, he didn't go there that day to try and hurt anybody. He was there to stand for our people. And, you know, we know he's not going to get bail probably, but I think we should be sending him letters too and Christmas cards, because he's still one of our folk, and he didn't try and do anything wrong, in my opinion. I mean, Billy, I know I might be stepping into controversial territory, but I want to know your thoughts on that, because, you know, we can't leave a single man behind who, you know, I mean, obviously, if someone goes out and does something crazy, right, that's like totally out of left field, totally, you know, totally just absolutely uncalled for and stuff like that. Well, you know, maybe he's not on Team White, right? If he's kind of driven himself away from the family. But in this case, I think all the POWs in Charlottesville deserve our prayers and support. I want to know your thoughts on that.
Matt, you know, I can sincerely, using just a little bit of imagination, imagine myself having been there in Charlottesville, having been involved in fights all day for my life, and then being separated from my friends and from my allies, finding myself alone, being lucky to find my car, getting into my car, surrounded by hostile screaming crowds and mobs, knowing that people were being beaten bloody all around me, and trying to just get out of the city, knowing that the police had turned against me and that they were not going to protect me. and then trying to drive through a crowd, knowing that the car was surrounded, and then having the car to be struck from behind and from the side by people who I knew, because it's happened over and over again, if they stopped the car, would drag me out and probably beat me to death, I might have panicked and hit the accelerator too. Certainly, he did not intend to hurt anyone. He was in a terrible situation with no recourse. He was trying to escape because he was in fear for his life. So we certainly should support him. The fact that no media outlet in the entire country has tried to interview him shows that they don't want to humanize him. They don't want to show the person behind the wheel. They want to put the car on trial. And as you said, he's already been tried by the controlled media. It's a horrible thing. But just like the media didn't want to talk about Jacob Goodwin's extradition fight until he's after he's already extradited, they don't want to talk about Fields. They don't want to talk about the boy behind the wheel. They just want to treat him like he was some kind of monster. Obviously, anyone in those circumstances would have done the same thing, and I would have as well.
Well, exactly. And this is, we're a family, right? And exactly as you said, the idea of fearing for my life, you know, there's that old saying, you know, it's better to be judged by 12 than carried by 6. And, you know, I mean, especially I'm, you know, a husband and a father, you know, but Mr. Fields was a young man, with his entire life ahead of him. And, you know, one has to think when you fear for your life. I mean, we've all seen the video of Reginald Denny, right? The, truck driver from the LA exactly. riots who ended up getting, you know, 200 stitches and beat nearly to death due to the color of his skin. You know, we've seen Black Lives Matter in Chicago and stuff like that pull white people out of their vehicles and beat them nearly to death. And you don't want to be the one that gets killed. You know, I mean, this is the sort of thing that this is a human movement. And I feel that it's always important, you know, we have the statistics, we have the numbers, we have all the things to back up our points. But at the end of the day, what this comes down to as a nationalist is that Jacob Goodwin, Dan Borden, Mr. Ramos, Mr. Fields, and all of the nationalists who have suffered, you know, this is our family. And you have to think, like, how you would feel to see your brother or your sister, or one of your little siblings getting bullied or picked on the, you know, on the playground or something like that when you were kids. Imagine now you've got the entire weight of Zog bearing down on men that only tried to protect themselves and their comrades. And let's not forget, on the Fields case, there was a state of emergency. That those people were violating the law and the order of the governor by being in the street, right? They all should have been locked up. If the cops had done their jobs, Mr. Fields would be able to drive home to Ohio and there wouldn't have been a problem. But of course, that's the true. Cops didn't do that. The cops wanted all of that to happen. And the left knows that they've got the support of the police, of the administration, locally and at the state level. But we've got to remember, like, when I say that we should write these guys letters, when we should support their funds for their lawyers and stuff like that, it's because they're literally your brother. They're our family, and we have to take care of them. If you wouldn't let your little sibling get bullied on the playground when you were kids, why would you let Zog bully your brother or your sister today? We've got to have their backs because we are one family. The Republicans ain't going to look out for us. Democrats ain't going to look out for us. The capitalist class ain't going to look out for us. The left wants to kill us, right? The only group of folks that cares about one another, you know, if you're white, is white nationalists. We care about each other. So, you know, I just want to say that, remember, especially as Christmas is coming up, that spirit of giving. I'm going to be writing an article on the Tradworker website, so we can send Christmas cards, depending on what happens tomorrow with bail for our POWs, so we can flood them with Christmas cards to show them our love and support, because that's the Christmas spirit, and that's the nationalist spirit. But I've been talking a lot. Mr. Roper, what's your final thoughts for the day? Because there is so much going on here nationally, locally, with Charlottesville. There's so much. What's your final thought?
Well, thank you for having me on again today, Matt. It's a pleasure speaking with you. I want to encourage people who may be blackpilled by what happened yesterday in Alabama to understand that this is a necessary step along the road to a white ethnostate, perhaps to several white ethnostates. And we should not be discouraged or depressed by the growing pains which we will experience along the way to our future white nation.
Amen. And this is what we're pushing forward to. And Mr. Roper, it's always a pleasure and an honor to have you on. Thank you for all the work you've been doing. You know, I've been talking with Mr. and Mrs. Goodwin as well, you know, a couple times a week, just checking in to see how they're doing. And, you know, all the love that they have for the support you have given them is amazing. And this is the spirit, ladies and gentlemen, of love, of fraternity, and of really of charity, right? Because, I mean, the Gospels for my Christian comrades, the Havamal and stuff for my Folkish comrades say very similar things. To care for those who are sick, care for those who are in prison, care for those who are hurt, care for those that are hurting, right? This is our calling as nationalists. It's not about getting on TV. It's not about, you know, getting your name in the paper. It's not about looking cool in cool uniforms, although I do like cool uniforms. It's about providing for those of your own family. And that's what nationalism is about. So thank you, Mr. Roper, for being on. Thank you for all that you've done. And thank you to my dear listeners. I'll look forward to being back tomorrow with another edition of The Daily Traditionalist. I hope you have a great rest of your day, and hail victory.
You've been listening to The Daily Traditionalist on Radio Arian at RadioArian.com.